Dr. Warwick Harton, Executive Director of the Marriage Guidance Council, author of the books Divorce Dilemma and Staying Married, introduces Jim Vickers-Willis.
Every day I am involved in helping people with their marriages and their family relationships. I'm constantly made aware of the part that ignorance plays in contributing to the difficulties that some people experience. It is important that people develop early in life the attitudes that will help them most as adults. This applies particularly to sexuality. In the program ahead, Jim Vickers-Willis attempts to fill in some of the gaps with information gleaned from his thousands of interviews over many years.
And here is Jim Vickers-Willis.
This is your big chance, and I guess it's my big chance too, and that's why I'm smiling, because now, for the first time, I'm able to pass on to you accurately what I've found out in all these thousands and thousands of interviews with people regarding their sexuality, information which is important to you and absolutely vital to any young ones in your family. So often when I've been on the television or the radio or in the press, what I've had to say has been cut, or sometimes distorted. Well, now I can pass it on to you accurately, just as it is. There is a debate. Should we have sexual education in our schools? Should we pass on to our young ones accurate, wholesome, helpful information as found out by researchers in recent times? Or should we force our young ones to go on learning about their sexuality behind the school shelter shed? It would be absolutely laughable if it wasn't so terribly serious. Our young ones, millions of them, are being crippled from age zero up to the teenage days by distorted, destructive, unnatural, untrue ideas and attitudes passed forward to us from the ignorant past. Now, it would be just the same with antibiotics or with blood transfusions. There are religious people who don't believe in blood transfusions, and they will stand back and watch while somebody else dies because of their beliefs. But do you want your children to be brought up with ignorance about these vital matters? Over the past 17 years, as I've interviewed these thousands and thousands of people, including psychiatrists, psychologists, marriage counsellors, homosexuals, divorced and separated people, prisoners in jails, prostitutes, you name them, I've interviewed them in large quantities about their sexuality, I've realised that thousands of devoted researchers around the world have been finding out accurate, useful information about our sexuality for the first time in human history. Information which has tended to dispel some of the myths and the taboos which have messed up so many people's lives. Now, do you want this information to be withheld from your children? A few years ago, I was lucky enough to meet a very distinguished psychologist, Dr. Bob Montgomery, and he and I got together and we made some sexual information audio cassettes. Dr. Montgomery has a saying. He calls it the censorship of silence in homes, and now they want to extend it to the schools. The censorship of silence. We talk freely about all other subjects, the football, the cricket, the tennis, anything you like, but there's no sensible, useful, helpful, constructive conversation and information about sexuality. The censorship of silence, which effectively teaches all young people that sex is so utterly filthy that it's unmentionable. Well, now, our programs ahead are aimed to help dispel this censorship of silence. I hope you enjoy them.
Some Sunday School wisdom. The Marriage Counselor's Dilemma. Masturbation and the Psychologists. Message from the Massage Parlor. The most important sexual organ in your body. Sexuality and your quality of life with Jim Vickers-Willis.
Sexuality is a beautiful and valuable part of every human personality. Far from learning to repress it and to fear it, we should be learning how to express our sexuality and to use it constructively to enrich our life and enrich our relationships. Now, why is our sexuality so important to us? Why is it so critically important? Well, our sexuality is an aid towards human beings gaining certain things which human beings badly need, such as closeness with another person. Our sexuality is a great aid to this closeness. And then interest and variety in life. Think how much less interesting life would be without our sexuality if we were, say, one sex, for instance. And then relief from tension. How many people are taking tranquilizers and sleeping tablets and have backaches and ulcers and blood pressure? Tension. When they have this relief from tension readily available to them always through their sexuality, quite free. And then something to look forward to in life. That's something that all human beings need, something to look forward to in life. How many people are saving up and saving up for this big overseas trip to try and make life exciting, when if they have a healthy attitude towards their sexual expression, they have something exciting always available to them to look forward to? I was teaching at Sunday school. My wife and I used to share a Sunday school class, and I asked the boys, what did King Solomon have besides 1,000 wives? The answer I was looking for, incidentally, was wisdom. One little 12-year-old put his hand up and he said, he must have had a mighty big bed, sir. Well, the reason I tell you that is that that little boy showed a nice, happy, guilt-free attitude towards sex. The fact that he was prepared to put his hand up in front of the class showed this. But so many people that I interviewed didn't have this nice, happy, guilt-free attitude towards sex. Deep down, they didn't feel so good about it. And how does this come about? Well, it seems that ever since we were little children, someone's been coming up to us and saying, take your hands away, stop playing with yourself, stop this filthy habit of masturbation. And this has made us feel not so good about our sexuality. I sometimes think about the mothers these days, mothers taking her little girl out of the bath, her little baby, and dusting her off with powder, and the little one's hand wanders down to her vagina and tickles it, naturally, and mother pulls her hand away and makes a little scolding noise. Now, why does mother do this? Well, mother's mother did it, and her mother did it too, and maybe the mother feels a little bit of shame about it. But it's a wonder that mothers don't think about this more these days, because there is information about now to show that although this doesn't mean much to the mother, it can be terribly important to that little one. Before it's even aged one, before it's aware of it, it's being made to feel negative about its sexual parts and about its sexual feelings. And this can be projected forward into adult life, reinforced with negative ideas and attitudes in the teenage days, and then carried forward into married life and into adult relationships, spoiling these adult relationships by this means. In fact, this whole matter of masturbation is very important. Of course, with this sort of program going out, maybe it will become less important. Well, now, I was on the television recently, and they were unwise enough to ask me about my own sexual life. Very unwise thing to do. So I looked straight into the television camera and I said to all the people at home, well, I masturbate. Do you? Well, the male compere nearly fell off his stool with shock, and the female compere, she laughed delightedly. And I wanted to say something else, but they quickly changed the subject to square dancing, which is something else that I'm interested in. I was quickly able to slip in. I said, well, that's probably the first time that's been said on television anywhere in the world, which reveals our silly, ugly attitudes towards a normal, natural thing like masturbation. What I wanted to say, and they didn't give me a chance to say, was that some weeks before, I had been talking to an interstate marriage guidance council. And afterwards, the executive director came up to me and he said, Jim, you have a very important message for all of us. But by far the most important thing you spoke about tonight was when you were so open and honest about masturbation. He said, I don't know whether you noticed, but up the back there were a couple of older male counsellors, and they shifted around very uncomfortably when you were so frank and open about masturbation. And he said, that's one of our problems. We have people out there counselling other people, but they've never come to terms with their own sexuality. I also wanted to say, but I was not able to say on that program, that I had seen a leading world actor who was married to one of the world's leading actresses come on international television and laughingly describe in front of an audience how he had been drunk for 12 hours continuously, and everybody roared with laughter. And I thought, well, what a disgraceful example this was, particularly for young people, for this world-famous personality to describe how he had been drunk for 12 hours continuously, and it was a funny matter. And I thought, now, if this man had come on television and he'd said that he masturbated or that he had a good sexual life with some girl, they would have been likely to censor him off television. One night, I was talking to 100 men and women at a dinner, And they all seemed to be saying that they knew everything about sex and they were very with it. So I said, all right, hands up, all the women here who masturbate. Well, everyone looked around at everyone else and a little titter ran around the room and then everybody burst out laughing and nobody put their hand up. So I said, well, it would be just the same if I brought a television camera and a microphone in here and I said, hands up, all the people here who pick your nose. I'd get exactly the same result because when you were small, you were all made to feel pretty bad about picking your nose, that it was a pretty filthy habit. But the truth is that everybody picks their nose, everybody without exception. Now, against that, I was giving a talk to 90 psychologists and social workers one day, and I asked the same question, and 75% of them put their hands up. Of course they did. They were psychologists, and they knew there was more likely to be something wrong with them if they didn't masturbate than if they did. And down the front, there was this woman aged about 47 or 48, and she had her hand up. So I walked down off the stage, and I put my arm around her and gave her a hug and said, good for you, because she'd been game to put her hand up in front of everybody. Anyway, there was a bit of a laugh, and the talk went on. We were talking about how many older people there are in the community who are lonely, but who deny their sexuality a great aid to bringing people into your life. They'd say, oh, I don't do this and I don't do that, and they're quite proud of it. And yet they're living lonely lives, denying their sexuality a great aid to bringing somebody into their lives. And this woman put her hand up and she said, Mr. Vickers-Willis, Mr. Vickers-Willis. And I said, yes. And she said, Mr. Vickers-Willis, my mother is age 75 and she masturbates. Well, there was quite a laugh from all these psychologists. And then this woman went on and she said, and my father died 18 months ago, and within 1 month, another man proposed to mother. And there it was, in front of all these psychologists, the exact case I was talking about. Now, I had a massage parlor owner come to visit me recently to buy some of our cassettes. A very good psychologist, Dr. Bob Montgomery, and I make sexual information cassettes. And this massage parlor owner had come down to buy these cassettes because some of his customers had sexual problems, and he wanted to lend these cassettes to them to help them, which was very good. But as he was leaving, I said to him, it's funny you being here because I am probably the last man who would ever be found in your massage parlour. And he looked at me rather strangely. I think he thought Jim Vickers-Willis would be more with it than this. And I said, well, I don't have these ugly attitudes towards masturbation. Any sexual expression that I couldn't get with my wife, I just get it by means of masturbation. I don't think that masturbation is naughty, dirty, sinful, guilty, nor is it a substitute for the real thing. I know it's an important part of the real thing and an important part of sexual training, so I wouldn't be likely to pay any of your girls a lot of money for the same thing. And so I can't help wondering how much of the need for prostitution is directly caused by these ugly attitudes towards masturbation, and how many of the sex crimes too. How many men go out and rape a woman when if they didn't have an ugly attitude towards masturbation, if they didn't consider it was an inferior form of sexual expression, they would just masturbate and they wouldn't commit this sex crime. In fact, I feel we should be having a look at these ugly attitudes towards masturbation for what harm they are doing in our community. Well, now, the female sexual problem, the main female sexual problem, is failure to explore the possibilities of their own sexuality. Get that? The main female sexual problem is failure to explore the possibilities of their own sexuality. Most women, most modern women, would hotly deny that they are still affected by that old syndrome, a nice girl doesn't enjoy it. But they still are. How many mothers boast about the fact that their daughter is a good sexual partner for her husband? Have you ever heard one? They boast about the fact that they're good cooks and good housekeepers, but how many women are really proud of the fact that they are a good sexual partner? And that's their problem, failure to explore the possibilities of their own sexuality. Now, the main male sexual problem is in an entirely different area. The main male sexual problem is performance pressure. The male has been conned and misled in his young growing up years into certain wrong beliefs and certain wrong values. Now, what are these values? The male has been led to believe that it's very important for him to have a big, strong erection and that this is a very important part of his manhood. Now, that's not true. He's also been led to believe that it's important to have a big penis. A small penis is bad. Now, that's not true. the male has also been led to believe that a man is responsible for a woman's sexual enjoyment. He's responsible. Now, that's not true either. These wrong beliefs, these wrong values put pressure on the male. If you ask psychiatrists and psychologists what causes impotence, they will tell you that it's performance pressure, but it's the wrong values behind the performance pressure that cause the difficulty. The big strong erection, the big penis. The man is responsible for the woman's sexual enjoyment. None of those things are true. A woman is responsible for her own sexual enjoyment. And these wrong beliefs put pressure on the male, and that pressure causes impotence. It all takes me back to Jimmy Durante, who said, "My father taught me so well about the birds and the bees that I can't get interested in girls." And in this whole matter of sexual education, ignorance is certainly not bliss. Dr. Bob Montgomery has a saying, a good one, and he says it often. The most important sexual organ in your body is between your ears.
Ignorance is not bliss for young people. The pregnant daughter. Irresponsible parents. Obscene four-letter word. The mother replacement syndrome. Alcoholism and drug abuse. Perverted censorship. Jim Vickers-Willis, for your children's sake and yours.
The first part of this program is for children and for parents of children, and the second part is for adults. Years ago, on a brief tour of the Western States with Dr. McNabb, we were really surprised at the ignorance of young people regarding their sexuality. My wife, in particular, was amazed at their ignorance and at how this was upsetting their young marriages. One 17-year-old girl came up to me at a school and she said, "Mr. Vickers-Willis, I'm pregnant. Where can I go for help?" And I said, "Oh, you must go to your parents." She said, "Oh, I couldn't possibly go to them." And I said, "Why not?" And she said, "Oh, they're very religious people." And I said, "What do you mean religious?" She said, "Oh, they never talk about sex or anything like that." Well, now that's a terrible definition of being religious, isn't it? And these parents leave their children out on a limb in danger just when they need support and help. Another 17-year-old was pregnant, and her father was so ropeable about it that he wouldn't have anything to do with it. And his wife took their daughter into the city to get an abortion. And I happened to be in their house afterwards, and I heard the father describe his daughter as a dirty little slut. And I said, "Oh, a slut." I said, "Tell me, what did you two teach your daughter about sexual education?" And the father said nothing, and the mother said, "Oh, I always told her that any time she wanted to know anything about that subject, she could ask me a question and I would answer it honestly." I said, "Well, did she ask any questions?" And the mother said, "Oh, over the years she asked one or two questions and I answered them honestly." And I said, "But did you give her any general sexual education? Did you buy a good book and read it with her? And in particular, did you give her information about contraceptives?" And the mother said, "Oh, no, nothing like that." So I then said in this tone, because I was trying to emphasise it to them, I said, "Well, you two are a pair of thoroughly irresponsible parents." Just like that. And the poor father, he nearly fell through the window with shock, and the mother looked a bit stunned. So I said, "Well, you might think this is rather harsh, but supposing with other dangers you'd taken this attitude, supposing you'd said to your children, 'Now, if you want to know anything about the danger of crossing the roads, just ask me a question and I'll answer it honestly.' If you did that and one of your children got run over, you'd know you'd been irresponsible parents." But that's the way many parents are still going on. And if the children don't ask the right questions, they don't get the right answers. Now, I'm not a counsellor, fortunately. That's why it's been possible for me to make these thousands and thousands of interviews. The poor old psychologists and psychiatrists and counsellors, they have to stay with people week after week, month after month, sometimes year after year, helping them and counselling them. But I haven't had to do anything like that, and so I've been able to cover a vast field, and it certainly has changed my entire way of thinking. Now, my telephone goes constantly with people ringing up with different problems, and the pilot program for this program was made at my home, and I was recording it at 1 o'clock in the morning when the phone went, and there was a young man with a drug problem. He told me his life was threatened. And it's these sort of calls that have given me the information which I'm passing on to you. This all started in London 17 years ago. I heard what a psychologist had to say, and it caused me to go out and buy a book on sex. Believe it or not, my first book on sex at the age of 47. And I was so guilty buying this book that I actually turned it over the wrong way so that the bookseller wouldn't see what I was buying. And after I'd read this book, I said to my wife, there's about one third of what I've found out which I knew nothing about. And here we are supposed to be educating our teenage children, and we're obviously passing on to them a lot of very dangerous ignorance. So having been trained as a journalist, I decided to write something about this, and I started interviewing people. And then someone in the marriage guidance asked me, would I like to ghost a book for them? And I actually started that book, but finished up writing my own book from many, many interviews. I found that many words are used in a misleading fashion. For instance, I was doing television ads and they allowed me to write my own advertisements. And I used to do one ad, I used to look straight into the television camera and say, I'm about to say the most obscene four-letter word you've ever heard. And I would pause, knowing that the staff in the television studio would have their finger on the button, ready to switch me off. And then I would say, kill. Can you think of anything more obscene than one human being killing another human being? And yet I can say that word kill freely on television, but another word which describes one person being kind and considerate and loving to another person, that word is considered an obscene word and I can't say it on television. Parents add to the confusion when they insist on using funny, childish names for their children's sexual parts. Many parents can't use the word penis or vagina. I heard one family call their son's penis a knotty, and another father called his son's penis a dingle-dangle. Now, what do we do to our children when we do this? Imagine if you went to your doctor and say you had a sore on your arm and you held out your arm and you said, Doctor, I've got a sore on my Erfel-Gerfel, say for a name. The doctor would look at you and he'd think there's something peculiar about this fellow. There's something funny about him that he can't call his arm an arm. There's something wrong with him mentally. And this is what we do to our children when we use these funny, childish names for their sexual parts. We make something special out of their sexual parts, something nasty. So we parents have to decide, are we going to stand up for our children? Are we going to insist that they have comprehensive sexual education? Because our children are at stake. But it's not just the young ones. It goes through all ages in our community. I remember a lady coming back into the country, and she said to her friend, a middle-aged woman, she said to her friend, tell me, Alice, have you yet been through the menopause? And Alice replied, I have not yet even been through the National Galleries. And that sort of ignorance I found very common in the community. Now, some people are quite worried about why they are not more successful sexually, and in these many interviews, I came across a few clues. For men, one was that many men seem to treat their wives as mother replacements. I couldn't help wondering what effect this had on the woman's attitude towards sex, because after all, women are turned on by men. They're not turned on by little boys. And one wonders, when a man treats his wife as a mother replacement, how difficult he makes it for her to respond to him sexually. And then women, one psychologist told me that he did a survey of women, and out of every 11 women he surveyed, married women, 10 of them said they were quite sure that they would be more successful sexually if they had a different husband. So here we have the woman not looking at her own sexual problems, but rather blaming her partner, which isn't going to solve the problem at all. People read glossy magazines with half-baked sexual information in them, and this information makes them feel inadequate. They feel that other people are much more successful than they are sexually. They read about someone who has 8 orgasms a night or some such. I was having lunch with Dr. McNabb one day, and he said this, it stuck in my mind. He said, Jim, if sex was always successful, it wouldn't be nearly so interesting. Get that? If it was always successful, it wouldn't be nearly so interesting. McNabb. And that tends to take the pressure off, doesn't it? Now, lots of people are worried about alcohol problems and drug problems, and I feel sexual education can play a big part here. I found, as I interviewed people, that the alcoholic was a lonely person, and the drug abuser was also a lonely person, I found that their problem was largely psychological, a problem often of loneliness. I felt that sexual education would help to ease this loneliness, and in fact I felt sexual education could do more to ease drug problems and alcohol problems than anything else in our community. In fact, so often I saw the situation of a mother with bottles of pills in her kitchen to help solve her problems, and then everybody was surprised to find that the young people growing up used drugs to solve their problems. And I was in a hotel one afternoon, and a man at the bar said, "Oh, we've got Jim Vickers Willis in here, and he says that we fellas are down at this hotel every afternoon and evening because we can't get on in our sexual lives with our wives," which was not exactly what I was saying anyway. And round the bar came this fellow who was no more than 40 years old, and he said, "Oh, well, Jim Vickers Willis, you can't say that about us. My wife and I gave away all that rubbish years ago." So there it was. And I felt, too, that a very confusing example was given to young people by many parents. For instance, one woman had been separated from her husband, divorced for 17 years, and she had had many lovers. And she said to me, "Jim, how can my 23-year-old son be so prudish and so uptight about sex, and he doesn't have any girlfriends and he treats me almost like a lover and doesn't like me having boyfriends?" She said, "How can this be when I'm so with it about sex and I've had so many lovers?" And I said, "Well, you know who caused it, don't you?" She said, "No." And I said, "Well, you caused it." She said, "Oh, how can you say that, Jim? I'm very with it over sex and I've had lots of lovers." And I said, "Yes, but you've always had your lovers up at the local hotel or motel. You've never had them at home. And as far as your growing up children are concerned, they think you've lived a celibate life for the last 17 years. And this is a very confusing example for young people. Sherry Height, I met her, the author of The Height Report, a very charming lady, Sherry Height, and she managed to get 3,000 women to fill in her 12-page questionnaires, an absolute landmark in psychology. The world of psychology has never been the same since she made that survey. And Sherry Height produced some answers that were pretty unacceptable to men. For instance, she got these 3,000 women in their questionnaires. A high percentage of them said that they were more turned on sexually by stimulation other than with the male penis. Well, that upset a lot of people, and when Sherry Height got into the press and on the radio, quite a lot of the male commentators didn't give her a very good go because it upset their male ego, the answers. But of course, this, for the first time in the world's history, 3,000 women told how they felt about sexuality, not how some man thought they felt or wished they felt. And censorship can be very confusing too, especially for young people, lumping together sex and violence and sometimes drugs. When they lump this together in censorship, I find censorship to be quite perverted. In fact, I was interviewed by one of the main daily newspapers in the country recently about a three-quarters of a page article, and a friendly article, an honest article, and an accurate article. But I said to the journalist, "You can't say anything really worthwhile about sexual education unless you speak about the ugly attitudes towards masturbation that go so deep in our community." And the journalist said to me, "Jim, we can't even print the word masturbation in our paper."
Personalized Height Report. Mutilation of girls, non-deliberate and deliberate. Women, it's not good enough. The anti-sex maniacs. Jim Vickers Willis, freedom, not permissiveness.
In Africa and in certain parts of Asia, millions of women have their sexual organs mutilated when they're small children. This is called female circumcision, and complaints have been made to the United Nations about it. This mutilation, this crippling, is effectively ensuring that these women won't enjoy sexual pleasure throughout their lives, or at least that it will be very much reduced. This is said to make them more faithful wives for the men. Now, we don't do this physically, but we do exactly the same thing psychologically in our society. Take that case I mentioned of the mother bringing her little daughter out of the bath to dust her off with powder, and the little girl's hand wanders down naturally to tickle her vagina, and mother pulls her hand away and makes a scolding noise. And how this negative attitude that develops before they're even aware of it can be carried forward into adult life. And then I saw an eight-year-old girl covering up her breasts, but she didn't even have any breasts. So many older women have come to me in my survey and have told me that they don't enjoy their sexuality at all. And yet one medical researcher said that women were better equipped physically to enjoy sexuality than men, that they had a bigger nerve and blood supply to the sexual organs. And he said, it's only the devastating, destructive ideas and attitudes passed on to people in their young years which robs people of what nature intended them to have. This researcher added that the highs and freakouts so desperately pursued by drug addicts were nothing compared to the sense of absolute exhilaration produced for a woman by one good, healthy orgasm. I was talking to a Muslim male in Yogyakarta in central Java recently, and he said that this mutilation of the clitoris, which was done on women when they were small, was necessary for their health. He said, if they don't have this operation done, it affects their health in later life. And I said, oh, that's not true. And he said, oh, yes, it is. He said, our religion and our traditions teach us that, and that's where the subject ended. But the clitoris in a woman is an organ which is put into the human body for one purpose only, to give the woman orgasm, to give her pleasure and relief from tension. There's absolutely no other reason for nature or God, whatever you subscribe to, having put that organ into a woman's body. And yet I found many older women who came to me in my survey who didn't know that they had a clitoris, and many of them didn't know where their clitoris was. So women, this part of the program is addressed to you. I'm saying that in this survey, I've found that women around the world are not getting what they should be getting out of their sexuality. It's just not good enough. One 80-year-old grandmother was at a hotel, at a motel, with her daughter, and there was a woman in the next unit who was having an orgasm, and apparently it was a honeymoon couple or some such, and the grandmother wanted to ring up the manager because she thought that this woman was dying. And her daughter said, oh, no, she's just having an orgasm. And the grandmother said, an or what? And it then came out that the grandmother not only had never had an orgasm herself, but she never knew that there was such a thing as an orgasm. Now, Sherry Height, when she did her survey, got 3,000 women to fill in her 12-page questionnaires, she made the number one chapter of her book, Masturbation, because she realised after doing the survey that masturbation was very important to women's sexual expression, and the publishers queried her making the first chapter masturbation. And in fact, what I'm doing is something like a personalised Height report. I haven't got people to fill in questionnaires, but I've been interviewing them in thousands and shorthanding their replies and tape recording their replies, and I'm just passing the information on to you that I got from all these interviews. Now, people like Dr. Bob Montgomery teach masturbation in their clinics, and sometimes they find with women that just teaching them to masturbate overcomes the entire sexual problem. In fact, I find that some people in the community are very negative towards sex. They call other people sex maniacs and nymphomaniacs. And usually I find that these words are used by people who are not very successful in their own sexual lives, and it's used about people who are more successful, so they call them sex maniacs. As I've seen it in this survey, there are quite a percentage of people in the community who are what I would call anti-sex maniacs, who are not getting much success in their own sexual lives, and they take a sort of dog-in-the-manger attitude. If I can't enjoy it, why should anybody else? And they're very negative to all sorts of things such as sexual education. And in fact, I find that the word freedom is being misused. It's a lot of people think of freedom, sexual freedom, as permissiveness. But there's no freedom in permissiveness in using your sexuality cheaply. Freedom, as far as sexuality is concerned, is being free enough to enjoy your sexuality in circumstances where it will enrich your life. In fact, I feel that we should be regarding our sexuality like a beautiful plant growing in our garden, and far from treading on it and crushing it and repressing it, we should be nurturing it and encouraging it and hoping that it will develop and one day it will bloom our sexuality and make our life more beautiful.
The prison of inhibitions. Square dance fears overcome. Who is a child molester? How normal are we? The results of the censorship of silence with Jim Vickers-Willis.
Inhibitions. Inhibitions are like a prison restricting your life and your happiness and your relationships. I was in a prison recently talking to the prisoners and I said to them, now, you men behind bars here, if you can throw away your sexual inhibitions, you can actually be freer than many of the people in the outside world. Now, what are inhibitions? Many people think of them as being some screwed up thing. Other people always seem to have them, their wives or their husbands or their friends. But inhibitions are just ideas and attitudes which we've developed in our life which reduce our happiness, make it harder for us to be happy and to enjoy life. I saw this very clearly when I was in square dancing and I was teaching sometimes 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people in a hall. And there would be men out there who would be tapping their feet to the music and they'd love to have been in it, but they had this inhibition that they were scared that they'd look a fool when they got on the floor and that would keep them out. And we'd use all sorts of tricks to get these men into the dancing. And then when they got into the dancing, they would turn out to be the keenest ones of all because, of course, they had overcome their inhibitions and now they were able to enjoy themselves. Well, now, normal. How normal are you? How normal are your friends? What is normal? A radio station rang me up recently. There was a child molester around, and this radio station rang me up to ask me, what would this child molester look like? And I think they were very disappointed in my answer. I think they thought I was going to say he'd have two heads and green eyes or something like that. And I said to the announcer, I said, well, he'd probably be somebody like you or me. And I think he was very disappointed in this answer. But actually, of course, these people are people, just ordinary people, who have had distorted ideas and attitudes fed to them when they were young. And sometimes these distorted ideas and attitudes lead on to distorted actions, such as rape. And they can also lead on to child molesting. But apart from this, there are many people out there in the community who have very unusual ways of expressing their sexuality. And the people who come to see me are just the tip of the iceberg, quite obviously. One man who came in told me that the only way he could turn on sexually was by standing in a window and masturbating, watched by somebody else. And for the past year, believe it or not, he's had a housewife living in the house next door who draws up a chair almost every afternoon and watches him masturbate, and apparently they both get something out of it. Now, you will say, well, this man is a very sick man, but he sits there in my lounge room, and he seems rather a nice sort of man, and he's very worried about his problem, which he's had since he was a small boy, and he wants to do something about it. And then there's another man who came to see me recently, about 48 to 50, and his problem was that the only way he can turn on sexually is to have another man walk around his house in the nude, singing songs like, pack up your troubles in your old kit bag and so forth. And he likes this man to pee in front of him in the nude. And when you inquire into the background of this man, who incidentally was a professional man and was employed by the government, when you inquire into his background, you find that he had a religious background. Both these men had very strong religious background. This one was a Catholic background. And when I asked about his parents and said, what sort of sexual life did they have? He said he had no idea. He didn't know whether they ever had any sex at all. And certainly they never spoke to him at all about sexuality. But one thing he remembered was that his father used to come into the bathroom in the nude and used to pee in front of him sometimes and used to pat him on the bottom. Well, no doubt the father did this because he was a nice, friendly person. Maybe the father even got something out of it that he may not have been getting closeness from his wife. But anyway, the son was picking it up, and the son was the only sexual feelings he was getting in his young life was this. And this apparently had led on to the fact that now the only way he could turn on sexually was to have men walk around his house in the nude, singing songs just as his father had done and peeing in front of him just as his father had done. And, of course, after I'd listened to this man for about 2.5 hours, I said to him, well, your problem is the same problem that all people have who have sexual inhibitions, and that is that you reduce the number of people that you can relate to. And he told me that he had to employ male prostitutes to do this, and he sometimes took men away for the weekend and paid for their weekend holiday. But these men, some of them no doubt, were homosexuals, and they wanted more than this. But he didn't want to engage in more. That was all he wanted as far as sexual expression was concerned. Well, now, you may say these men are very sick men and they need treatment, but have a look amongst your friends. How many of your friends can enjoy their sexual lives? How many of them only enjoy their sexual lives, sexual expression, occasionally? But most important of all, how many of your friends who are married together, how many of them don't enjoy sex in their marriages at all? So when you look at these men and find that they've found some way of expressing their sexuality, can we say that these other people who can't enjoy sexuality at all are more normal than them? In fact, are we passing on to our young ones attitudes and ideas and an example which will help them to live a normal, happy life? It's very hard these days for doctors. Many of these problems come to them and they haven't really been trained for this and they haven't got the time and they do their very best to cope with it. But I was talking to one of my doctor friends aged 50 recently, and he said to me he was in a group of 8 doctors and a discussion arose about what did they take to go to sleep at night. One doctor said he took this sort of sleeping tablet, another said that, and out of the 8, 6 of those 8 doctors were taking sleeping tablets to go to sleep at night. And my friend said, oh, well, I never take sleeping tablets. When I can't go to sleep, my wife and I usually roll over and make love, and then we both go to sleep naturally. And he said some of those doctors looked at him as though he was not normal, as though he was rather peculiar.
Depression and underlying stress. Causes of illness. Ugly attitudes and the dilemma of homosexuals. If God had intended us to go nude. An immediate drop in all sex crimes. Dr. Reich and cancer. And now the endorphins. Jim Vickers-Willis, you can't replace a relationship with a pill.
Some people may call this the Way Out program, but in my opinion it's one of the most important of the programs because it includes questionings about such things as drug abuse, alcoholism and cancer. Questionings which I haven't heard anywhere else. Now, some people, following my long survey, some people find my questionings to be way out, to be taken with a pinch of salt. Well, you will have to judge this for yourself. As I've seen it, many, many people are way out on the wrong side of their sexuality, having brought forward into their lives unnatural, distorted, destructive ideas and attitudes regarding their sexuality, brought forward from the ignorant past. And these ideas and attitudes have destroyed a lot of their happiness and made their relationships much more difficult. But some of these ideas and attitudes are so deeply embedded in our community that when anyone comes along and speaks something more logical, more true, it tends to sound way out. Well now, what are some of these ideas and attitudes? Well, you can quickly see one in regard to nudity. How many people in our community have feelings of shame about certain parts of their human body? They wouldn't like other people to see these parts of their human body. Now, how logical is that? After all, we're all human beings, we're all men and women, we're all just the same. Why should we feel feelings of shame about certain parts of our human body? And yet, when we go into certain areas and we try to set up legal nude bathing beaches for people to swim in the nude, there's an immediate outcry from people who feel that something obscene is going to happen with mothers and fathers and little children going down and swimming in the nude on these beaches. In fact, even something sinful. One woman came onto the television and she said, if God had intended us to go nude, he wouldn't have given us clothes. It's worth thinking about. And these attitudes towards nudity restrict people and stop them from enjoying what is a very good natural pleasure, nude sunbaking and nude swimming. In fact, there are far too few simple pleasures still available to people in life. And then there's another attitude towards homosexuals and homosexuality. Well, now, these attitudes of the community towards homosexuality are quite okay, nothing wrong with them at all, just as long as you don't happen to be a homosexual. If you do, well, then they are absolutely diabolical, and they lead on to laws which restrict homosexuals and discriminate against them and make life hard for them. A big section of our community, millions and millions of people, a big minority, the homosexuals, and their lives are made less happy by these laws, some of which are quite barbaric. Now, as I started to write my first book 17 years ago, certain people led me along lines of thought. One was a detective. He was the deputy head of the New South Wales Detective Force. And he said to me, "Jim, the day we get legal nude bathing beaches all around this country, that day you will see an immediate drop in all the sex crimes. What we so badly need in this area of life is more openness and honesty." And all my thousands of interviews over the years have only underlined that what that man said was absolutely true. And then there was a Dr. Wilhelm Reich. He was a student of Freud back in the 1920s. 1922, he was a student of Freud. He came to disagree with quite a lot of what Freud was saying, but Dr. Reich in the 1950s was making certain statements about sexuality. And in fact, he died in the 1950s, and in my opinion, he was victimized as a result of his outspoken comments about the repression of sexuality. He made certain predictions, because Dr. Reich was a scientist, predictions which have since come true. But what he had to say about sexuality was that he considered that because of repressive, unnatural, distorted ideas and attitudes brought forward from the past, millions of people were not getting adequate sexual expression in their lives. Not only did this upset their happiness and reduce their happiness, but it affected their health. It caused the human body to disease. And one disease Dr. Reich mentioned specifically was cancer. Well, that interested me, and of course, needless to say, Dr. Reich was howled down from one end of the world to the other. But what is interesting is that since 1975, in recent times, there have been investigations into these things called endorphins, which they've suddenly discovered in the human body. Endorphins are a sort of natural opium, and they've found that there are receptors in the brain for receiving these endorphins. Apparently, the human body produces this chemical under certain circumstances. For instance, if a runner is running in a marathon, he's under great strain, all of a sudden he will find that he is floating along because the endorphins have taken over in his body and it eases the strain. And if a person has had their legs cut off in a motor car accident, they'll find that human beings can withstand great pain amazingly because, of course, these endorphins have been released to help cope with the situation. And they've also found that in circumstances of great ecstasy and pleasure, human beings release these endorphins into the body. Well, of course, my thought immediately is, what about what Dr. Reich had to say? Is something like this happening in our human body when we have an orgasm, a woman has an orgasm, or a man has an ejaculation? If something like this does happen, then Dr. Reich was not so far off the track way back in the 1950s, was he? In fact, as I've done all these thousands of interviews, I've realized that many, many people are saying that all illness, or a great deal of illness, great deal of ill health, is connected with stress. And I can't help wondering how many people cause themselves underlying stress by the restriction of their sexual life, by the repression of their sexuality. How many are causing themselves underlying stress and perhaps causing themselves illness? Now, there was a Dr. Caprio too, who made a statement in a thesis on women. Dr. Caprio had written 24 books when I read his thesis on women. And in this thesis, he said he'd never encountered a case of a woman with an alcohol problem, but behind it, he didn't find that there was a sex problem. Well,
That really interested me. I wondered, did this apply to men too? And in my investigations, I tried to look along this line to see whether people generally who were uptight over sexuality were more inclined to drink a lot of alcohol, take a lot of drugs, and to become alcoholics. And then there was Dr. McNabb. He was doing a survey on women over the age of 40 taking tranquilizers and sleeping tablets. And Dr. McNabb said, to put it in a nutshell, Jim, you can't replace a relationship with a pill. Well, now, all these findings, all these questionings, all these answers, do you find them to be way out? Do you think perhaps we should be inquiring along some of these lines to see if we can find real solutions to some of these problems, such as drug taking and alcoholism and marriage breakdown? Or do you perhaps consider that somebody like me is some sort of a crank? Do you? Well, if you do, I must refer you to my father, Pa Vickers Willis, John Vickers Willis, who, apart from being a very kindly and courteous man, was also something of a philosopher in his own right. And back in the days when they used to use crank handles for starting motor cars, Pa used to say, cranks were made for starting things.
New answers to urgent problems. Vital importance of comprehensive sexual education. Orgasms are good for you. Dispelling the censorship of silence with Jim Vickers Willis.
Orgasms are good for you. That was the original title of my first book when I started writing it 17 years ago. And that title so shook my friends and relatives that I actually changed the title to Are You Really Fun to Live With? I remember a young man, quite a fit young man, a tennis player, who had a very crummy topspin forehand. And when I met him 20 years later, he still had this crummy topspin forehand. I remember thinking to myself, what a pity he didn't go to a good coach and learn how to make the strokes properly, and then he would have been a better tennis player all his life. Similarly, with sexuality, and our grandchildren ask the question, are you teaching us the right ideas? I believe we should have a new attitude towards what is moral, that anything that's pleasurable should be regarded as moral, provided that we don't harm anybody. And if you harm anybody, then you should have another look at it. I found in my survey, too, that there were two groups in the community as far as sexuality was concerned. There was the group who valued and respected their sexuality, and there was the other group, what I would call the prudish permissives. It seems so often people thought that prudish people were the opposite of permissive people, but they're actually the same people, two sides of the same coin, because, of course, neither person really respected or valued their sexuality. Now, people wonder where they can go for help. Well, of course, you can go to people like Dr. Bob Montgomery, a very good psychologist, or you can write to an organisation, the Quality of Life Association of 2 Dendy Street, Brighton, 3186, Melbourne, Victoria, Australia. QLA will send you a list of books and tapes and also addresses of counselling organisations who can help you. And if you wish, please write to me personally, care of the same address. Now, what we have in these programs is simply a report of what I've found out there in the community. I was talking to one woman one night recently, above average educated woman, a school teacher, and she was saying to me how terrible it was that some parents still made their children feel guilty about such things as masturbation. But she went right on and she said, it worries me sometimes young Johnny walks across the lounge room holding his penis. I hope he doesn't become obsessed with his penis. And I looked at her and I said, there's only one person who's obsessed with his penis, you know. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, you. And she looked a bit shocked and I said, well, now, if Johnny walked across the lounge room holding his big toe in his hand, would you become worried that he'd become obsessed with his big toe? And in fact, many parents withhold this sort of information from their children, imagining they are sheltering their children from something. Goodness knows what they think they're sheltering them from. So if you're a young person watching this program, then be very thankful you have thinking and thoughtful parents.
Now, my grandson, aged 9, watched the pilot program of this, and afterwards he said, Jim, he said, all the kids in our class should be seeing this program. Now, we've put together these programs in the hope that they will bring greater understanding and greater happiness in relationships. It was Dr. Reich who first interested me in the idea that when a person has plenty of sexual expression, this person gains physical as well as psychological benefit. And in fact, the investigations into the endorphins have added to this picture for me. But whatever it is, whether it's endorphins or something else, I'm quite sure that when a human being has plenty of good, happy sexual expression, that human being, that person, is a happier and healthier person. And in fact, after this long survey, I feel that that original title was right. Orgasms are good for you. May I wish you good luck.